UK Wine Show, show number 144. Ali Mamari from Kisara Wines on wines and grapes of the Bega Valley. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 144 for the 20th of February, 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we're continuing our talk with Ali Mamari from Kisara Winery in Lebanon. We talk with him about Bega Valley, the grapes grown, and how they express themselves in the wines. In the spotlight, we start looking at wine and food, and our quote is, "Wine is the healthiest and most hygienic of drinks." Who said that? Clues throughout the show? Answers at the end. But first up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. The BBC4 documentary series about wine began this week, focusing on a year in the life of Berry Brothers and Rudd, the UK's oldest wine merchant. The programme gave a great insight into how the company go about purchasing wine from producers in Bordeaux and Burgundy. The second episode will be aired on Monday the 23rd of February, entitled The Faith, and will concentrate on the 2008 growing season at Chateau Margaux, one of the five first growths of Bordeaux. The final programme, The Future, features retired Professor Upa Rangaka of Mahudi Wines in Stellenbosch, the first black-owned vineyard in South Africa, and Mark Soames, neuroscientist turned winemaker of Franschhoek's Soames Delta.
I know we mentioned the show a month or so ago, but I watched the first episode. While it was less about Berry Brothers and Rudd than BBR during their last year's On Premier campaign, it was still a very good, warm, fuzzy documentary. And I certainly think it's probably the best bit of wine TV we've had so far this year. So if you didn't see it, watch it on BBC iPlayer. And if you did see it, the next one, as Jane said, is on Monday night. What's going on in New Zealand, Jane?
Well, there's a surplus of Sauvignon Blanc in New Zealand, particularly from the Marlborough region, which had a 61% increase in production in the 07 vintage. And it's thought that this is fueling sales of the variety in Australia at discounted prices. The surplus has seen price promotions in shops showing cuts of several Australian dollars per bottle during the past 6 months. A big harvest in 2008 and expected again in 2009 will see this supply trend continue, increasing the likelihood of discounts in the UK market. And with a high euro making the price of Australian and New Zealand wines relatively more attractive, demand for New Zealand's Sauvignon Blanc could soar.
I think if the price of New Zealand wine does not drop in the next 6 months, it'll be because of merchants trying to maintain margins. With big crops in 2008 and people like Marlborough winemaker John Forrest advocating tipping some of the lower quality 2008 wine out to make room for 2009 vintage, it's likely that some will be sold off cheap and land up here in the UK. Even so, with the New Zealand dollar dropping in value along with the pound, New Zealand's 2008 and 2009 vintage look set to increase sales in the UK as they have in Australia. Speaking of Australia, what's the Fosters up to, Jane?
Well, following a review of its wine assets, which started in June 2008, drinks giant Fosters is to retain its wine business, but run it as a separate entity to its beer business. Its brands include Lindeman's and Penfolds, and though the wine business has been underperforming, the review concluded that there were opportunities to make substantial operational improvements. But it means 36 vineyards in Australia and California, covering 5,000 hectares, will be sold off, and 37 low-end brands will be discontinued. Other changes include the closure of its Denman plant in the Hunter Valley, the original Rosemount winery. The company said the planned changes will cost $60 million Australian dollars a year, but will result in savings of over $100 million Australian dollars a year from 2010. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can go to our website 3050.co.uk to get all these stories in full.
Cheers, Jane. Fosters decided almost a year ago that they'd paid too much for their wine assets, and they were overvalued taking into consideration the oversupply in Australia. I'm pretty sure they would have tried to sell them if they could have, but they couldn't in the current oversupply of wine and the lack of money by big players to buy them up. Let's face it, buying vineyards is an expensive business. So to stop the wine assets weakening their stock price, they've decided to split them away from the beer business, and I hope that the beer business stock price will recover. Hopefully both stock prices will rise, but this year shouldn't be the problem that many people were predicting. The heatwave that started all the forest fires has meant that the crops have been greatly reduced. And this means that Australia's supply and demand looks like being closer in balance. Another tough year for Australians for sure, but not back to the problems that Marlborough's got or they had back in 2006 with their full tanks. That ends the news. Next up, we've got the spotlight. This week, we're looking at wine and food matching. We start by getting a fairly high-level overview of the do's and don'ts. The key to wine and food matching is obvious. The only golden rule with food and wine matching is, when matching food to wine, make sure you like the wine and the food. If you don't like either, then you won't like the combination. It sounds obvious, but many people get bogged down trying to find the perfect match and lose sight of just simply enjoying the wine and the food. Around 10% of wine and food are great combinations. 10% don't work at all. And around 80% of the remainder will probably work with about 80% of the wine. The key is, if you like the wine and you like the food, there's only a small chance that it'll be a really bad combination. But if you don't like the wine or the food, you're unlikely to like any of the combinations. There are other guidelines for wine and food matching that you should consider. Note the word guidelines. These are not rules. The enjoyment of wine and food combinations is such a personal experience that it's impossible to find combinations that everybody likes. But you can work with the natural characteristics in wine and food to enhance them, so that most people would prefer that combination. But with all wine and food matching, it's one part science, two parts black magic. So the guidelines are, match the weight of the food with the weight of the wine. This key guideline is very important. That is, there's no point matching a delicate wine with a big, heavy, hearty stew. The white wine will be lost with the weight of the stew. Similarly, a huge, heavy wine, such as a Barossa Shiraz, won't go with delicate seafood. You'll just lose the flavour of the fish being lost. Number two, salty food and tannic reds are a bad combination. Salt tends to highlight tannins. While some tannins are enjoyable, many people like combinations that mask tannins rather than highlight them. As a result, tannic wines and salty dishes tend not to work. Acidic wines work well with oily and fatty food. Acidity cuts through oily dishes, providing a refreshing sword, cutting through the fat and oil of some of the food. For example, a crisp Sauvignon Blanc or champagne goes very well with fish and chips. The next rule is sort of a combination. Umami in wine works well with salty dishes, and acidity in wine also works well with umami in food. Now, wines don't normally have salt, and umami can come from wines exposed to yeast for long periods of time, such as vintage champagne and sherry. So, sherries and vintage champagnes, try having them with something a bit salty, and you'll see what I mean. Beef and mushroom dishes, which are high in umami, work well with the crisper styles. Guideline number five, dessert wines should be sweeter than the dessert. Your mouth when eating or drinking will come accustomed and desensitized to the taste and the aromas that you're consuming very quickly. So, if you're having a very sweet dessert, you'll quickly become used to and expect that rich sweetness. If you then drink a dessert wine, which is not as sweet as the dessert you're having, it'll taste relatively dry. It'll feel like you're eating the dessert with a dry wine, which is unlikely to go. And finally, hot spicy dishes can be cooled by sweeter styles of white wine with refreshing acidity. Sugar and sweetness in wine can be used to soften the effects of hot food, while wine with acidity will encourage the development of saliva in your mouth to cool them. Be very wary of tannic wines, as the heat often accentuates tannins in wine. That ends the spotlight this week. Next week, we're going to be looking at the guidelines and work out specific combinations. One combination is cheese, which is often considered a great match for some wines. And the personnel quote had a huge impact on milk and cheese production. The quote is, if you recall, wine is the healthiest and most hygienic of drinks. It was said by a Frenchman. His greatest work from a wine perspective was the discovery of a microorganism causing fermentation. But he was also heavily involved in the immune system and developed a process of giving people weakened versions of a disease to vaccinate them. Any idea who it is? It's a lot easier than some of the other obscure quotes we've had in the past. He was born in Jura. You may remember a couple of shows ago we spoke with Wink Lorch from the Jura Valley. Well, in this week's interview, we're talking with Ali Mamari. We're going to be talking to him about the grapes grown in Lebanon. Let's have a listen to what Ellie has to say. Hi, I'm here with Ellie Mamaro, and we're going to be talking about Kassara wines today. How are you, Ellie?
Hi, fine, thank you.
Excellent. Kassara is the oldest and the biggest winery in Lebanon, aren't they?
This is true. It has been established by the Jesuit in 1857. So we celebrated our 150th anniversary last year. We wanted to have a big celebration in Lebanon, but unfortunately with the situation in Lebanon, we couldn't make it. So we made it in London last year in November.
Excellent. What was the problem there? Was it the Israeli...
Exactly, yes, the Israeli intervention and the friction between the Lebanese, between themselves. So that's why we couldn't do it. We couldn't invite people from outside because it was very risky that the airport could close at any moment or clashes would take place. We don't know where. So we prefer to do it in London and invite our clients and our representatives.
Okay. Your wines are sold in London. Are they sold anywhere else in the world?
We sell our wines to 53 countries. All over Europe, in the States, in Canada, in Africa, in Arab countries like Syria, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, Qatar, Syria, it's all over we can find it. In Australia, in New Zealand, we have a Lebanese guy living there and having a restaurant. He's importing this some cases into New Zealand also.
Is it mainly, I've seen, for example, one of your competitors from Lebanon, Chateau Moussa. I've tasted that quite a bit in the past. And I see that in the high street, you know, in the supermarkets occasionally. But your wines, I haven't really seen around. Do you mainly gear them towards the restaurant market?
Yeah, exactly. For the moment, we only sell to Lebanese restaurants and to other Asian restaurants and some other. So we're spreading the sales in restaurants for the time being, which we call the on-trade. We're not on the off-trade, but we have project for the future to go into the off-trade also. Yes, Chateau Moussa is the pioneer who he opened the road for all the Lebanese producers, and he's very famous in the UK.
Yeah, definitely. But you guys are bigger.
Yes, we are bigger and a lot more older because he's well known in the export market because since the 1975, 1976, he left the Lebanese market and went out to the UK, his major market, and he started. While we did not, we started really exporting since the 1996, 1997, not before that.
Okay, so it's mainly a push for you guys. But you're now targeting the export market, or are you still very much a domestic?
We want to keep the first position of the on the Lebanese market, and we intend to keep this position. And we're out on the export market. As I told you, we started in 1997, and now we export to 53 countries. But our main market is the domestic market. Our production is increased, aiming for the export market more and more.
Okay. How many hectares or litres of wine does Lebanon produce? Because I understand you've got something like a 38% share of the market, which is huge.
Exactly. That's our share. Xara's share is 38% of the local production. Lebanon produces something like 6 million bottles of wine. And Xara's share is 2.4 million of those bottles, yes.
Okay, so that's quite a big one. You seem to have a lot of grape varieties that are French. Yes. We've tasted a range of your wines just recently, and they all seem to be, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon dominated with a bit of Syrah, and Petit Verdot seems to be an interesting grape variety you're growing a bit of there. Do you want to tell us a wee bit about what grape varieties you're growing and why you're growing those?
Yes, we're growing a lot of what we call the noble grapes, that Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Petit Verdot, for the whites, Chardonnay, Sauvignon, Clairette. What we're trying to do is bring other alternatives than the Cabernet Sauvignon. Cabernet Sauvignon represents the largest part, but we're now we're experiencing new grape varieties like the Petit Verdot, which is doing extremely well, which brings a lot to complexity to the wine. We use it in our chateau and in our cuvée Troisième Millénaire. We have another grape, very rare grape variety called Arinard Noir, which is a cross between Merlot and Petit Verdot.
Yeah, I'd never come across that grape variety until we'd tried it today.
It's extremely, extremely rare. In the whole world, there's only 122 hectares. And we have something like almost two hectares, 1.87 hectares of Arinard Noir. It's an extremely rare grape variety, but extremely fragile, meaning if we have a lot of sunshine, this would not bring it to maturity. On the contrary, it will burn out and not mature, because the skins are very thin and the surface of the leaves is not enough to cover all the... that's the main problem of the Arinard Noir. So we produced in 2004. 2005, we couldn't produce any of the of this grape variety because it was burnt out. We had something like 1 week of almost 40 degrees and it was burnt. 2006, we have an exceptional crop of Arinard Noir as well as 2007.
To me, I always think of Lebanon, even with your altitude being quite high, I always think of Lebanon as quite a hot country. What do you think is the best suited grape variety to Lebanon?
It is true that Lebanon is a hot country, but we have an exceptional microclimatic conditions in the Bekaa Valley. We have the altitude, that's to start with, and then we have a 20 to 25 degrees of difference between the days and the night. So during the day we can have temperature like 34, 35 degrees, but during the night it drops to 12 degrees. Is quite cold but this is due to the altitude. So when we harvest the grapes, we start at 5 o'clock in the morning and we stop at 10 o'clock. And when we bring the grapes to the winery, the temperature of these grapes is an average of 14 to 15 degrees, which is exceptional. The yeast cannot start working at this temperature because it's too cold for the yeast to, so still sleeping. So sometimes we have to wait for 2 days for the yeast to start working. And this permits for the vines, we extract much more polyphenols from them by the maceration phenomenon. And this lengthens the fermentation. We do not wish to that fermentation is finished in 3 or 4 days. We wish it to continue to 7, 8, 9 days.
I notice in quite a lot of the wines we taste, particularly the Cabernet Sauvignon wines, a slight menthol greenish tinge to the wines. I thought it was quite a nice level of complexity, added complexity to the wine, except for one of the vintages where there was quite a strong green note there. Do you have problems with the vines shutting down during the growing season or stop photosynthesizing?
We have sometimes when the temperature goes more than 45, 36, 36 degrees. But as you know, during this period of the day, meaning midday till 3 o'clock, the photosynthesis is closed because of the extreme heat. So the spores, they close in order not to stop the chlorophyll from circulating, and we have no photosynthesis during this period. But there's a disadvantage for this. It shortens the growing season and the maturity season, and we have something like...
It shortens the
growing season because afterwards the chlorophyll has to work to double its work, and we're losing some of the polyphenols. That is, in some of the years, we have this problem. And this menthol notes, it comes from the mineral soil. We have a lot of mineral in the soil, and the climate, and the sun. It is typical for the Lebanese ones, these tilleul, menthol...
Eucalyptus
characters.
I've always like eucalyptus with Australian wines. You always associate maybe as flavors coming off from maybe gum trees and things like that. Eucalyptus trees.
We have a lot of eucalyptus trees in the Bekaa.
Oh, really?
A lot of eucalyptus tree. In Xara we have more than 200 trees. And very old trees.
Oh, see, in parts of Australia, they cut them down because they don't like that flavour getting into the wine.
Yeah, I know, but in Lebanon, we kept them. We don't find this as being harmful to our. It gives it personality. It gives a character to our wines. I don't think this it's eucalyptus that. I'm not convinced that these eucalyptus would influence the wines. I think it's more the sun, the soil, and that influence that gives this mental.
The wine I really liked the most was your Blanc. I think you call it Blanc de Blanc, is that right?
Yes, Blanc de Blanc, yes.
Why do you call it Blanc de Blanc?
Because it's issued from three white grapes. We have 55% Sauvignon, 25% of Chardonnay, and 20% of Semillon. The Chardonnay is fermented in oak for 8 months with batonnage, élevage sur lit, lees, steering.
Okay, it tasted to me quite like a sort of a... four or five-year-old Semillon from Hunter Valley, which had that slight lanolin notes to it. It was quite nice. I quite enjoyed it.
Well, it has very good acidity. That's the secret in making this wine. It's the Sauvignon is harvested in two times, so we have two harvests for the Sauvignon.
What?
30% of the Sauvignon.
Twice a year, or?
No, not twice a year. We have two harvests.
Two passes.
Yes, two passes, exactly. One pass for the when it's not quite ripe, and then another one with the at the right ripening point. 30% almost out of it are harvested at the maturity that under mature.
What do you think is your best wine, or the wine that Casara does best?
Well, we have our chateaus that are really, really excellent. We have our best seller, which is the Reserve du Gouvin. And what I'm really, really proud of is our Cuvée Third Millennium, Cuvée Troisième Millénaire, which is 40% Petit Verdot, 30% Syrah, and 30% Cabernet Franc. This is really great success.
And what's your biggest commercial success?
That's the Reserve du Gouvin and the Rosé Sunset in the Rosé and the Blanc de Blanc in the White.
Do you see a difference in styles that the Lebanese people like versus London people?
Yes, our wines they fit quite the taste of the English people. There are some wines that in Lebanon we can hardly sell them, and they sell quite well in London, like the Gris de Gris. You cannot sell it in Lebanon, or you sell it in small quantities, but for the UK, it's our first market, as well as the Blanc de Blanc is huge sales in the UK, double than what we do in Lebanon.
Oh, interesting, isn't it? What, do you think it's a mixture of the food or the people?
Well, I think that the Lebanese, they prefer more rounder white wines and less acidic wines, while the Blanc de Blanc has good acidity that goes well with the fish and type of food that they make. That's
okay then, Elliot. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Hope you enjoyed that. That almost ends the show this week. Next week we're going to be talking with John Forrest from New Zealand. With New Zealand Pinot Noir winning pretty much all the top Pinot Noir competitions in the UK over the last couple of years, and Otago in particular becoming the hottest Pinot Noir growing region in the world, we talk with John about a new sub-region in Otago known as the Waitaki Valley. But before we finish up, how are you getting on with the quote? Wine is the healthiest and most hygienic of drinks. Well, it was said by Louis Pasteur. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.